invited and contributing to that. Imagine something strange. Of course, you're going to laugh, but it's okay. How about if electromagnetic wave is a one huge, big, stationary wave in which you have a traveling wave? That's when you look at that video that I have sent you. It shows a traveling wave over there. Now, it could pass, it could be partially absorbed. John, can you put some more wording in English to that?
When that diagram builds up to a black wave that looks like a pulse going back and forth, I think the video is trying to say that that is the exciting energy that's being placed into that network on each individual cycle, that they are launching that impulse in order to continue all of those individual higher harmonics that combine in that particular way.
So the why is then being called traveling wave equals? See, it's the name on it, particular name on it by the scientific entity that manufactured that video.
I think every so-called standing wave is at least a pair of traveling waves in the opposite direction.
And John is right. Possibly. John, pick up.
It's sort of like which came first, the chicken or the egg, Dick. Those waves that are called standing waves seem to be, their summing seems to be the resultant of that black wave that you're looking for that actually reverses polarity and travels back and forth while the others are not really moving.
I wonder what Glenn has said about it.
We got to be careful how we interpret that particular YouTube. Don't forget now that a number of these YouTube videos are somebody's computer-generated simulation, and not all the time do they represent reality. So what is the generator of that YouTube video trying to tell us about those individual waves and that resultant black wave that looks like a pulse going back and forth? Is there an explanation anywhere as to what he was modeling and what it represents, and is it real?
Dick's question is my comment.
They have sent you it's a can with the paint on it, and the Faraday's waves are being delivered to that, and then you see how it behaves. And this is not the computer generated. This is the actual video. It actually could come to the same point. John, pick up.
Glenn had a comment. Go ahead, Glenn.
I guess my confusion goes back to Dick's question, which is, what exactly is this whole model altogether? I guess I just don't have enough information yet. Unfortunately, guys, I have not looked at that video yet. I promised to look at it this week and to spend some time to really analyze it. But unfortunately, Wesley, with a lot of these videos, I'm not sure if they expect you to know something else. It's like, to me, a lot of them, they're fascinating videos, don't get me wrong, but a lot of times what I'm seeing is things without enough explanation. It's amazing results, but I need to know more. it's like, for me, it's like I came in the middle, I missed chapters, you know, 1 through 4. So until I catch up and figure out more about how that video, you know, relates to exactly what it is, I'm left with asking myself a lot of questions. Unfortunately, that's my comment. KC2QIQ.
Well, if you can look at the computer, you have this 30-second video. John has it, and John can better explain how that video looks like. John?
That's a difficult thing to describe, Wesley. He has to actually look at it and think about it, and I'm sure he'll come up with some good examples. But, you know, maybe we're trying to attack this from too many areas at the same time. I think we, if we can, get back to the simple bar magnet and try to determine which way have we reached a decision. Is it a wave? Is it a particle? Is it a field? What is actually going on with that? And when the magnet is in a slight motion, is it a wave? I mean, we stick with the simple ends first before we get too esoteric.
KC2QIQ with a comment on that one.
Also, does the electromagnetic field has a mass? And if it does, how can you measure the mass of magnetic field?
One step at a time. Go ahead, Glenn.
Well, keep in mind, this is my understanding of this, and it's going to sound a little confusing in the beginning, but when you look at a magnet, and a magnet's got a north pole and a south pole on it, and it's got a magnetic field associated to that mass. But the mass, as we can definitely define it, is the magnet itself. Now, let's say we were in as close, that magnet was sitting in as close to a pure vacuum. That means that there was really nothing around the outside, and no particles were coming off the magnet. Basically, you can say that the mass is the center of the magnet itself. There's a definite mass there. Now, as far as the field goes, that static magnetic field around the outside, it has a dimension. It has lines of flux that surround that magnet. But if it's in a vacuum, it's there, and it's not doing any work. It's kind of static at that one point, and it's just a field. There's no photons associated to that outer rings of field that's going around the outside outer areas. There's no mass in that outer area. So I would say at that point that that outer field lines of flux are relatively massless. KC2, QIQ.
Is it a circulating field, Dick?
Don, good question. It took something like a circulating current to generate that magnetic field. But what the heck is the magnetic field itself? If somebody posed you that question, Glenn, that magnetic field is something you can sense. It appears to have no mass. We believe it traveled from the time it was created, that the change in the strength of the magnetic field, we believe that the delta change moves at the speed of light. But what the heck is the magnetic field itself? I'm reasonably sure it's not made out of electrons. I'm reasonably sure it's not made out of protons outside of that magnet. What the heck is that field? If somebody asked you that question, how would you answer it, Glenn?
Well, it's not an easy one. I mean, it's easier to attack how it's generated initially. In other words, if we look at the mass of a magnetic material and look in the center and we break it down into its chemical structure and then start looking at what the shorted dipole looks like as a magnet, and we can determine that, you know, all of that material stuck together generates a north pole and a south pole. It is polarized and is creating that magnetic field around the outside. It's almost as if you had an inductor in free space that was shorted. So if you were to look at it as a shorted inductor with a current flowing through it internally at the subatomic level inside that little material mass called a magnet, you can generate a field. So basically that H field that's not moving back and forth, it's just static around the outside, is just the remnants of that reaction that's taking place within the magnet itself. So the field, provided it's in a vacuum outside of the magnet itself, is just a static field. So, I mean, there are, you know, E and H fields that aren't associated to mass. They're just lines of flux. KC2, QIQ.
What is the lines of flux, and does a magnetic field represent energy?
I would say, Wesley, that it does represent energy, but not a kinetic energy. It's just a static field. So in other words, it's a potential energy sitting out there in space, not changing. But within the magnet itself, there's a chemical reaction taking place that I said that's basically like having a shorted inductor with a electric field moving within it. That's within the mass itself of the magnet that's actually creating that energy that's developing the field, but the static field around the outside itself isn't doing any work. It's just kind of stored there, while all the real energy that's taking place, or the real source of that magnetic field, is taking place within the magnet itself.
If magnetic field is an energy, then the energy is also photon. Photon is the pure energy, but magnetic field is not energy. So what kind of energy is that?
Very simple, Wesley. A photon is energy respected to a mass or quanta. Okay, in other words, when the minute you're talking about photon, you're saying energy and mass together, okay, at the atomic level. So you're looking at the smallest particle of that mass, and you're saying there's an energy associated. That's a photon. But you can have energy all on its own without mass. KC2, QIQ.
Okay, so that energy that you explained with respect to photons, could you explain it with respect to the magnetism.
Well, when you say magnetism, magnetism usually means a force between two magnets. Is that what you're relating to? And it's I'm just want to check you on your words to see if I'm answering your question correctly.
Well, when you have two magnets and they are too close with north poles towards each other, then you are actually contradicting the energy of each one, and then they are trying to repel. Now, if this is not a mass, if this is not a photon, what is that? You beautifully explained photons. So far, I didn't hear the explanation for the magnetic field.
By the way, Glenn, you said the magnetic field is due to the chemical reaction within the magnetic material. I have to ask you, what is a chemical reaction? Over to you, Glenn.
I'm sorry about that, Dick. That's a bad choice of words on my part. One of the things I've been doing this week is looking at the atom itself, studying the energy equations again, something I haven't done in 20 years, I might have to add. And it all comes back to chemistry. So when you're looking at the makeup of an atom and bonds and the structures within, you know, different elements, everything goes back to chemistry. So when I'm talking about chemistry reactions, what I'm really talking about is the makeup of the atoms and the molecules within the magnet itself that make up the magnet, that are actually creating that magnetic field, which is the equivalent of an inductor in a basically with a continuous current running through it, like a shorted inductor. So that interreaction that is actually taking place within that material called magnet. And, of course, by using different materials, you can actually create stronger and stronger fields. So that I understand my choice of words for the, you know, for the reaction that's taking place within that magnet. I called it a chemical reaction, where I should have really said it's the chemical makeup of the magnet itself that's creating that effective, you know, continuous current, as if it were modeled as a continuous current inside a shorted inductor.
Well, let me say this before that. The chemical reaction dies with the time. The energy of photon dies with the time. Why then the energy, as you said, of magnetic field doesn't die?
WS2N?
So I got an answer to that one.
Glenn first, and then Paul in that order. Go ahead, Glenn.
One of the definitions of a magnet, in other words, when you have a north pole and a south pole on a material, one of the things that makes it a magnet, Wesley, is the fact that the way that all of those molecules within that magnet are all lined up in a row, they are in a dipole. But what's interesting, which means that they're polarized dipole, but what's interesting about them is not only are they configured in a charged dipole, but they're also electrically shorted. That means that the voltage across the material is zero. So there's always an electric current running within that material. Isn't that something? Dick, over to you. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
We really complicated it now.
Yeah, I've heard it as a bunch of domains that get all lined up when you magnetize a material. And each of these domains have, spin of the electrons, they've got spin of the protons.
High-tech term for current flow, Dick.
I accept that. Okay. You're lining up all these spins and making them their axis of spin all collinear. That's what I think is going on when we align all of these domains. And so, yes, the cloud of electrons does represent a kind of local current flow. That generates this thing we call a magnetic field, a solenoid inductor with current flowing through it makes a magnetic field. So we're talking about ways of making it. We haven't got the vaguest idea what it is, but maybe John does. Go ahead, John.
What gives the continuous not dying power of this shorted circuit?
NWS2N.
Can I answer that one, Dick?
Yeah, we've been bypassing Paul for a long time. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I remember a long time ago we talked about what makes the magnet continue to go forever. You know, you attach it to a piece of metal in the basement somewhere, and you come back 20 years later, and it's as strong as ever. And it's the constant movement. You know, I mean, the molecules really don't stop. So my guess it was the movement of the electrons constantly going. But I was going to talk about what you just mentioned, Dick, the spin of the electrons, all lined up, and chemically, maybe that's what John was talking about, you know, the chemical makeup of what this is. You know, if it's copper, it's not going to have characteristic of having magnetic property unless you put a current through it. But if it's steel and you have it magnetized, you're going to have all the spins of the electrons lined up, and they're going to have what they call the domains, like what you mentioned before, Dick. And then you're going to have the all the domains lined up, and that creates your field. So you have to go back to, you know, not so much what the whole field is, but what's that, the field of that one electron that's spinning. And do you stop that electron? And once you stop that electron from spinning, does the field go away? That's what I'm curious about. I had one question about time that the main reflectometers, Dick, later on before the net. Back to you.
Yeah, we're going to put you on the list. At the molecular level, Glenn, do you have an understanding, I do not, about what is different about copper versus steel? Steel seems to have this property you and I call coercivity. Those domains can be lined up with a strong external magnet, and they stay lined up. They get locked in place. Yet copper doesn't have that characteristic. What's wrong with the copper molecule that it won't do that? Over to you, Glenn.
Well, what's interesting is that it's not it's not just copper. It's most materials don't do that. As a matter of fact, the only material and its isotopes and its variations and alloys that separate it is iron. Iron is the key material. What Wesley was talking about, and everybody keeps on talking about the same thing in science, in other words, why doesn't the magnet run down? If we look at a capacitor, and a capacitor's got charge on it, Wesley, most people can see that charge can kind of stay there, and if it was a perfect capacitor, the charge would stay there forever, and that voltage would be on the capacitor if there was no leakage or breakdown. It was a perfect, ideal capacitor. Most people accept that fact. What most people don't realize is when you look at the inductor, let me let it drop for a second. Inductors have a very similar property as do the capacitor. If you have an electric current in a completely lossless inductor, there's no losses in it whatsoever, and a current flows into an inductor that's shorted, that current will run forever. Now, what's interesting about iron and an iron material, and this is, and Dick, as I said, I'm not going to explain this properly because I don't 100% understand it myself, but I do know that the properties of iron can be aligned in the domains that you've mentioned that at the molecular level line up into what appears to be, or can be modeled as, the shorted inductor. So that at that molecular level, and the way that it's arranged, that you can actually induce that current, and it stays there forever, losslessly, because the arrangement of the iron will allow a path for current to flow within it, such that it just models the perfectly shorted inductor with a current flow in it. I unfortunately think I'm sure that's not your answer, but I'm going to look into it more and see if I can answer that question better for you by next week. KC2QIQ.
So what then is the resistance of an iron coming from? If you can magnetize iron and it still have resistivity, Glenn?
KC2RFM.
Alan recognized. As I see it, I can make a cryogenically cooled magnet by having current flow that creates a magnetic field, and ordinarily that current flow would die down by the IR drop. But as long as I'm using superconducting materials and not a cryogenic temperature, I make the current flow forever, and I've got a magnetic field that in theory lasts forever. At the molecular level with these iron materials, I'm creating a kind of very local current flow. I'm lining up the spin of the electrons and the spin of the protons, and because of their coercivity, they somehow get locked in position as if they were cryogenically cooled, but they're not. They're at room temperature. And by the way, most magnets have a so-called Curie temperature. You heat the magnetic material up to a high enough temperature, most materials will lose their magnetism. You break down those locked domains, you jiggle them around enough, and all of a sudden they're not lined up anymore, and you lose the magnetism when you go above the Curie temperature. That's another clue. Alan, what in your mind makes that magnetic field? KC2RFN, K2RIW.
Okay, it's really not speculative at all. It's just that those of us have learned, it's been so long since we've learned it, we've forgotten it. In organic chemistry, it's very well described why the iron molecule acts the way it acts. It kind of gets artificially pumped up to a higher potential just based on its makeup. And it doesn't fill all its orbitals consecutively like other atoms do. For some reason, it'll half fill the orbitals. It just has to do with the makeup of it. If anybody wants to learn it, just pick up a college-level organic chemistry textbook, because there's no heavy math involved, and it's pretty simple. I don't remember all the details because it's been years, but when I was pre-med, I took organic chemistry, and it was very, very well explained, and it was very elegant. Let me just drop.
KC2QIQ with a comment on that?
I have a question.
What I was saying is that when you start filling orbitals with oppositely spinning electrons, you start off in quantum from 1s2, meaning two electrons oppositely spinning, 1s2, 2s2, then you get to 2p6, and then 3s1, and so on. And in the iron molecule, for whatever reason, which again is very, very simple, they will actually, half the orbitals will fill up to a higher energy level. And that's it. And then you can understand how it bonds with other molecules, and that's organic chemistry. So it's really very simple. So if you want to know, Wesley, it's really very easy. Just pick up organic chemistry textbook and read about the properties of iron, and you'll get it.
Can you tell me then what is magnetic field?
You know, like I said, you can certainly get that and read it for yourself. It's probably a lot easier for you to read it. But if you want, just for you, Wesley, because you're such a special guy, I happen to have my organic chemistry textbook at the office. And when I get a chance between surgeries, I'll sit down, read it, and then I'll summarize it for you on the next TechNet.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate that. But could you, in pure, simple words, answer the question?
No, I can't. It's been many, many years since I looked into that phenomenon. But of course, as we were studying the properties of molecules and how they link together, which is what organic chemistry is really about, the bonding of molecules and atoms, and then, you know, what neat properties happen when they combine together. And it's fascinating stuff. And the magnetic field of iron is interesting, but it was more of a side note, so we didn't really focus much on that. But it really is very simple and very elegant. And I'm sure once I review it, I can give you that answer, no problem. Is that good enough for you, Wes?
Well, thank you very much. It is good enough for me. I'm going to be waiting for the material. John had a question, and I'm waiting for Glenn's answer.
Yeah, we got Glenn and John in that order. Glenn, are you sure that iron is the only material that's magnetic? How about neodymium, and how about boron? Over to you, Glenn.
Glenn, that's a Glenn-John hybrid.
A hybrid has magnetic properties.
Okay, let me wait for the drop.
Much energy in a Glenn?
See, I've been actually... Alan, it's funny that you mentioned this, because actually I've been really, really digging into the chemistry books to look up this answer. And here's what the real stick is to this. Iron is really the only material that has this property. And what's funny about it is that you can basically dope the iron with other alloys and basically create other alloys, especially steel. And when you look at the chemical equation and you start basically looking at each shell or orbitals, and you basically put in the electron charge, and everything wants to fall into the neutral state because iron in its basically wants to be in its neutral state so that you have a balanced number of protons and electrons, and then you got your neutron count without the isotopes. What's interesting is that if you take that and you do the other mixes, steel and everything else that you're mixing with the iron, or you want to dope it up with other materials to try to strengthen and increase the density of this field, there is no initial magnetic field. You drive a current through the material, and all of a sudden you create a domain inside of it, and then there's a new alignment. And that alignment starts the current flow, and then it doesn't stop. But what's interesting is, what is the motivating factor? And I think that's really what Dick's question is. What is actually that kicks it off? But Dick, actually, there's always iron inside of that material, and it has to be aligned in just the way to get that exact count, so that it will always, when I say count, I'm talking about electron count, so that between each level that it aligns up just right, so that the valence shells and will allow basically the electron coupling to align the spin. But initially, if the material is just formed, it won't do it on its own. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I've got a question on that, but let's go over to John first. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGV. Yes, Dick. Now, something in your field, you're used to doing a lot of testing, and I'm sure you developed a lot of ways of doing it. I'd like to know if we had, back to the simple bar magnet, and we're looking at the electric field, how could we develop a test to see if it is a circulating field? Because if it's a linear field circulating at the same rate, we have no flux change. How would you go about that? And I often wondered if the doctor could tell me, does hemoglobin collect at a magnetic point if you put a magnet on your body?
You want to take that one, Alan?
There have been some quack therapies based on that, and the answer is no.
Yeah, a lot of these people think that if they wear magnets on their clothing that they're going to be healthier. I'm very skeptical of that. What do you believe is taking place in some of these alloys of stainless steel, which seem to have no corrosivity? There are certain alloys of stainless steel which you cannot make a permanent magnet out of. Any idea what's going on there, Glenn? Maybe that's a clue?
So, Glenn, could you also relate to hydrogen 1, carbon 13, fermion 19, and phosphor 31? All of this have magnetic properties, especially hydrogen 1.
Yeah, those are the materials that are independently detected because of their particular wavelength of emission in a magnetic resonance imaging or a nuclear magnetic resonance machine.
Dick, hydrogen is not a material. It's a gas.
I call it a material, but I know what you mean. Over to you, Glenn.
Well, what's interesting is that all materials that have iron in its makeup have the capability of becoming magnetic, but not all materials that have iron in it can be magnetic. And it depends on its spacing and alignment and how they're actually placed. And this is what this has really been the holy grail that I'm looking for right now. And I know the answer is there. And I can see that in iron and looking at the different energy shells within a quantum model, because remember, it's still the cloud model, and you put it there and you get the alignment and you see that everything wants to fall to its natural balance, you know, between the protons and the electrons. And of course, then you apply an energy flow, and then it starts up the chain reaction. What the part that's really, really fascinating me is that is the motivator that really sets up that chain reaction. I mean, anything that you do to break the, in other words, if you put another dope it in such a way that you break up that interreaction of shells between each iron atom, it will stop. So you have to have that correct order to create a domain and start that electromagnetic field going. But here again, there's lots of ways of making it stop. The interesting thing is, how do you do the analysis to make it start? KC2QIQ.
Question, Dick.
Just the unique geometry of the iron atom that permits it to have that strange property, strange and wonderful property.
Yeah, but Alan, permission is one thing. You can have it all lined up, and it won't have a magnetic field until you actually energize it.
Glenn and Alan, in this order, is there any material, is there any way I can make a magnet where I don't use one single molecule of iron? Can I make a magnet, I'm not meaning I'm talking about electromagnet, can I make a permanent magnet out of anything in that periodic table if it doesn't contain a molecule of iron? Glenn first.
I would say, Dick, I don't know of any, but here again, it would basically have to have a 3-2-2-1 property, which means that depending on how the electrons line up, so that as one kicks off, the other one reinforces right behind it, so that you have, as one is going to the higher level, the one goes to the next iron level, and it just keeps on moving down the line. But what's also interesting is it has to come back in the opposite path. Now, here's the interesting part. When you put the material together, you can start the domain by energizing it and getting it to go, and then it stays. That's really cool. Now, is it possible to take some other chemical compound to make it happen? I would imagine there probably is. I just really haven't thought about it and or how expensive it would be to make that kind of a process. But none of the ones that I've seen out there that have magnetic materials don't use iron, as far as I know, Dick. Alan, over to you, KC2QIQ.
KC2RFN. No, I do not believe you can have a self-sustaining magnetic material that isn't iron. Again, it's the property of iron, specifically its geometry, that give it its property. However, you might be able to do it if you apply energy. Enough energy, you can probably fake it temporarily.
But it will make iron. It will make iron if you do that.
I have a question to Dr. NMR, proton nuclear magnetic resonance, is based on permanent magnet properties of hydrogen. How can you then relate hydrogen structure to the iron structure?
My understanding, should I get this?
You got it, Alan.
I've read a lot about NMR, which got changed to MRI because there were nuclear-scared people. My understanding of how MRI machine works or NMR works is, you're putting hydrogen, you're looking at the hydrogen in the water of whatever it is you're looking at. Maybe it's a chemical sample, maybe it's a human being. And by putting it in the static field, the hydrogen is aligning. And then you blast it with some RF, and you get an angular displacement. And then when you shut off the RF, that angular displacement can be measured, and thus an image can be formed. But that doesn't imply that there's some sort of magnetic property of hydrogen that's being utilized here. So I think you have your premise either wrong or your nomenclature's wrong.
Glenn, do you have a simple explanation for ferromagnetic, paramagnetic? There's three or four kinds of magnetic properties. What do those words really mean, if you happen to know, Glenn?
Dick, am I making a repeat with the HT?
You're 80% noise.
I moved a little. Is that better?
Not really. Alan, are those various magnetic words, was that explained in your organic chemistry class?
Can you say the terms again, Dick?
Ferromagnetic, paramagnetic. There's three or four kinds of magnetic words, and they all have a meaning. Go ahead.
My understanding I'm getting from this of this conversation is from organic chemistry, and didn't really focus on the magnetics and the ferromagnetic. No, so the answer is no.
WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, You were talking about a magnetic situation, not dealing with steel. The only thing I can think of is hydrogen, the closest thing to it, and that would be at the center of Jupiter. We have an iron core in the center of the Earth. In the center of Jupiter, you have this hydrogen core, and it's so dense that they actually call it a metallic core, and because of the spin of the planet, it creates the biggest magnetic field throughout the whole solar system. So, it's not a permanent magnet like you're looking for, but it just shows that almost anything, even hydrogen, could develop a magnetic field, under the right circumstances, Dick. And a question on the time of main reflectometer when you get a chance. Back to you.
Diamagnetic, paramagnetic, ferromagnetic, and magnetic. What is the difference between them?
Yeah, I don't know. I've read the definitions when I've Googled those words, and boy, it didn't make sense to me on the first reading. Maybe I have to read it a few times. John, have you made sense out of those words?
KC2QIQ.
There's a man that'll do it. Go ahead, Glenn.
When we talk about ferromagnetic, I'll tell you the two that I know. The ferromagnetic is part of most of the magnetic fields associated to iron and the geometric chemical placement that we were talking about earlier. The paramagnetic, if I remember correctly, is based on the study of quantum within a quantum model. In other words, if you look at the three basic energy relations to mass, in other words, you've got charge, mass, and spin. And spin can be in one-half orbitals positive or one-half negative. Neutral spin is referred to as magnetic charge, and I believe that's called paramagnetic charge of the nuclear analysis of an atom, Dick, KTORIW. KC2QIQ.
I think that was John. Go ahead, John.
Negative, Dick, wasn't me.
It was Wesley.
You got it, Wesley?
The materials, they are referred to the term ferromagnetism. They're iron, nickel, cobalt, gadolinium, and dysprosium. And they had the unique magnetic behavior, which is actually called ferromagnetism because of iron ferrum in, that's from Latin. And that's what I know about it. And that includes also rare earth magnets. As far as paramagnetism, some materials exhibit magnetization, which is proportional to the applied magnetic field in which the materials is placed. These materials are said to be paramagnetic. And this is justification was made by the Courier law, and that would be magnetization M equals C, which is the Courier constant, times B, which is magnetic field, divided by T, which is the temperature in kelvins. Now, as far as... something that is very much common to all of this is the atomic response to the Lenz law.
Earlier tonight, Wesley asked the question, is there energy in a magnetic field? And I say yes. Obvious by the fact that when that magnetic field suddenly collapsed like it did on the Large Hadron Collider, all kinds of damage took place. In other words, energy was pumped into the system to align those domains, to create these coercive effects in these magnetic materials. That doesn't mean that energy of the magnetic field is continuously flowing. It's only when the magnetic field is being built up or collapsing that an energy transfer takes place. Very similar to what happens if I take a spring and I compress it, and I wrap waxed twine around it to keep it compressed. It has potential energy because it's got a force, and it's being restrained from using that force to deflect something, like moving a mass. Let me drop. And just for a second, I'm gonna jump over to a fun experiment, a fun puzzle. If I take an ordinary steel spring, or maybe make the spring out of a titanium, a non-magnetic material, I take a titanium spring, and I compress it, and I wrap it with a waxed cord, and I drop it in a vat of acid that will dissolve the titanium, and the acid doesn't have any effect on the wax string. Eventually, the spring is gone. What happened to the potential energy that used to be in that spring? Glenn first. Go ahead, Glenn. I'm going to ask each one of you guys. K2RW, you got it, Glenn.
Well, that spring obviously at one point had to be released, and at the moment it released, it was extended.
No. I've got this spring with 10 pounds of force. I've compressed it. It used to be 6 inches long. It's now 2 inches long. I wrapped it up with wax twine. It stayed 2 inches strong, long while I put it in the vat of acid. No physical length change of the spring occurred. Just the individual coils got smaller and smaller in diameter, and finally the spring is gone.
The structure of an atom, I mean, of the particles has changed, and the bonds between the particles.
I don't think that the wax and the titanium or whatever the metal is are going to dissolve at the same rate, Dick. I think there's going to be a point at which that energy is released. But I want to hear your answer on this one. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
It turns to heat. I chose a wax string, assuming that the wax string has no effect in the acid. And if you don't like the wax string, I'll use some other material, plastic or whatever. I'm using some material that the acid does not attack. The material is continuously holding the spring compressed as the spring dissolves in the acid. Various people are going to jump in, but Glenn first. Where did the potential energy in the spring go as it completely dissolved into that acid? Over to you, Glenn.
Well, I would imagine as it's dissolving, the material itself is dissolving, it's being pushed away at the rate it was compressed at. So I would imagine that it's still mechanically maintained as it's dissolving. So as it's dissolving, that material is being repelled away as it's dissolving.
What does repelled away mean? I had a certain number of joules of energy in that spring because I compressed it. Where did those joules of energy go as the spring got dissolved in that acid?
Well, I would imagine that as it's dissolving at that particular point, it's whatever crystalline is holding that material together in a solid is going into a liquid that it's being dissolved into, and it's being repelled away. So I would imagine probably the resultant force would be heat.
Okay. Assume I've got two springs side by side. One is compressed, and I'm dissolving it in the acid. The other one is uncompressed, and I'm dissolving it in the acid. And assume for the time being that they both dissolve at the same rate. What's the difference in those two materials? You're going to tell me that one of them created more heat. By what mechanism did it... Heat means that the molecules of the acid, after the dissolving, are moving faster. That's what heat means. Who made those molecules in the acid with the compressed spring move faster? How did that happen when the spring never moved? Over to you, Glenn.
Don't really know, Dick. Let's pass it around for somebody else to take a whack at it. Dying to hear the answer. KC2QIQ.
Try.
I know that Alan knows. I know that Paul knows because they've heard it. John, what would your answer be?
Well, Dick, I'm assuming that the spring would start to dissolve and the diameter of that wire the spring is made from would be reduced, so the spring is actually going to start relaxing.
Isn't that happening with the... I got two springs side by side. One was compressed before it was being put in the acid. The other one was non-compressed when it was putting into the acid. They're both dissolving at the same rate. you're going to tell me that the acid with the compressed spring is now running hotter. Hotter means the molecules of the acid are moving faster. How does that happen, John?
So the process is taking pressure to relax. The other spring is just laying dormant, dissolving.
Oh, you got completely covered, John. Try it again.
I said the one that's been compressed, the diameter of the particular wire is getting reduced, so the spring is starting to relax. The other one, they're dissolving.
They're both dissolving at the same rate. How does the compressed spring end up with the molecules of the acid moving faster? How did that happen?
I don't know what you mean about the molecules of the acid moving faster.
The only way that the energy of the compressed spring can eventually be coupled into the acid is in the form of heat. The acid has to be hotter on the beaker of the compressed spring. Therefore, the molecules of the acid are moving faster. How did that happen?
That I can't tell you.
Isn't it because the molecules of that compressed spring is the energy that was compressed in it? Now, when you are attacking the bonds of between the molecules, it is just happening faster. Am I right, Wong?
You told me there's extra energy, and I told you that ahead of time. I know what Alan's going to say. I'll give Alan a chance first before I give what I think is an answer. Alan, what would you say? How did the molecules of the acid of the compressed spring end up moving faster? Over to you, Alan.
I was going to say exactly what Leslie said. The compressed spring, the molecules are forced close to each other, and then that acid to the spring, the energy goes somewhere, and can only go into the medium, and it can transfer the energy there, almost like uncompressing.
But you're stretching, or you actually, I have no words, whatever. You're just changing the molecular bonding by compressing. That actually in the acid is the first that make easier for the acid to react with it.
N-U.
But you also put heat in when you compressed the spring, did you not, Dick?
Negative. You didn't put heat. No heat at the spring took place when you compressed it. All of the stored energy was mechanical stored energy in the spring. Alan, you're much more of a chemist than the rest of us. When acid dissolves a material, what is the acid doing to the material? Over to you, Alan.
I think it is too late for me to be thinking that deeply.
It's depleting the bonds, Dick.
Okay, here's my explanation. The outer fibers of the spring, because the spring is being compressed, the outer fibers are at greater tension. In other words, the individual fibers in that lattice that you and I call solid material, called spring, when you heat up a material, the individual molecules dance back and forth in place. Now, they're all locked in position. That's what a solid is. But they're able to wiggle back and forth at a faster or slower rate depending on temperature. But when you compress a spring, you have taken those individual bonds between those individual molecules of that lattice and you have stretched them. There is individual minor springs at the molecular level. As the acid dissolves each one of those molecules, they come flying out of that solid at a greater velocity because you're releasing a minor spring that existed between that molecule and the rest of the solid material. So step by step, as each molecule dissolved off of that spring, it came off of the spring at a higher than normal velocity because the spring was under tension, because it was compressed. The outer fibers were under tension. It's simplistic, but for me it sort of works. Maybe it does for other people. KQRIW.
Yeah, but Dick, isn't that pretty close to what I said initially? In other words, I said when you're putting it inside there, it's basically as dissolving, that energy is basically being displaced within in there. I mean, I didn't use the word spring and velocity, but I think that's pretty much the same thing.
You told me that the energy was released. You didn't tell me the mechanism by which In other words, the individual molecules were stretched from their normal position. They were under a local microscopic tension. When they came flying out of there, they came flying out. It's like breaking a rubber band. You've got a brand new velocity when you break that rubber band, if you know what I mean. You didn't use quite enough words to give me a warm and fuzzy feeling on that one, Glenn. Go ahead.
I guess my background, Dick, is that every time I think of heat, I think of velocity, and especially at the molecular level, so I missed a few words on that one. K2RIW KC2QIQ, I yield.
Now, the reason I use that example is because I've got stored a potential energy in that spring, and until I release it, and when I do release it in that particular dissolving experiment, it comes off as extra heat. Thereby, well, the advertisement goes by.
System, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Okay. Now, when it comes to a magnetic field, you've put energy into the system when you created the domain alignment, the alignment of those domains. You've created a brand new condition. You've put energy into it when you establish the magnet. The coercivity of the material allows you to retain, because of its retentivity, you retain that magnetism. If you now do something to make that magnetism disappear, you're going to get that exact same amount of energy back. When I raise that material to the Curie temperature where it loses the magnetic field, I'm guessing if I had a magnetized magnet and a non-magnetized magnet, and I heated up each of them equally, put them in the exact same flame, I am guessing the one that was previously magnetized, as it becomes non-magnetized, ends up hotter. That's my guess. But I'm not sure now at the molecular level what's going on. Maybe somebody's got a guess on that one. K2RIW.
Yeah, can I mention something about Curie temperatures and ferromagnetic materials?
Go for it, Glenn.
One of the things, if you... everything from ferrites to most materials that basically have ferromagnetic properties to them have a Curie temperature. And what that basically is that when that material is pressed and bound together with binders, it holds a specific position. And unfortunately, with temperature, you can reach points where the binder breaks down. And as the binder starts to break down, that position of that material is no longer in that same crystalline structure any longer, and when that structure breaks down, then the ferromagnetic properties break down as well. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I agree with Glenn, WS2N.
Sounds good, Glenn. I can now take a neodymium iron boron magnet, a rare earth magnet. I raise it to the Curie temperature, it loses its magnetic field. And you're saying that a chemical change took place. I put it right back into that magnet that established the magnetic field in the first place. I think I'm going to get most of my magnetic field back once I remagnetize it. So the chemical change that you just talked about, if what I just said is true, and I'm not sure, but if it is, the chemical change that you just talked about appears to be a non-permanent chemical change, that it almost comes back to near normality when I cool it down, because I can now remagnetize it. Over to you, Glenn.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely, Dick. Let me let it drop for a second, though. Depending on the material and whatever the binder is that holds it together, like if you look at, like, let's say, E-cores, which are, a mixture of different powders put together, and sometimes they use actually, like, glue to actually hold some of the stuff together. Some of those, if you heat them, they may not come back and may not have the exact alignment. But when you get to stuff like neodymium, what's actually making that binder is actually a much, much stronger kind of a bond that holds it together. But keep in mind, the temperature that you raise it to will still affect the crystalline structure such that it will break up that domain and prevent the magnetism or that magnetizing current, like that shorted current inductor model that we're talking about, break up. But there again, if the material is rigid enough to maintain its original properties as the temperature reduces and it comes back into alignment again, it could be reinforced with that domain and start the magnetism start all over again. That is definitely a possibility with some of the more rigid bonds. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
John, you own quite a number of magnets, and you're enough of a scientist. I'll bet you you've put at least one of them in front of a blowtorch to bring it to the Curie temperature to lose the magnetic field. And I think these neodymium magnets also have a chromium coating on them to make them look good. I'm guessing that when you heated one enough to make it lose its magnetism, I'll bet you it looked pretty ugly after that. KC2WGB, KQRIW.
I sure have, Dick. You're absolutely right. I actually took bar magnets, put them in an annealing oven, which is exactly what you're saying, and the magnetic material realigned the elements. Those domains were scattered, but they were able to be remagnetized. I didn't do it with neodymium. Glenn may be right about the physical bond being so strong, but definitely in the annealing oven, lost all magnetism.
How did you bring it back?
One thing that really is important to me. Let me drop it.
And John, the answer, how did you bring it back?
I put it back into a magnetizing bar and remagnetized the steel, and it worked fine.
So with other magnets, physical magnets.
Do you own one of those huge electromagnets or one of these huge steady-state magnets that you put something in it and it becomes magnetized? Is that what you're saying, John?
Yes, I do have those, but I actually took it to a magnetizing platform and remagnetized it a little bit stronger than what it was originally.
Isn't that amazing?
What is a magnetizing platform? Give us a couple of words on that one.
It looks like a lapping block. It's about 10 inches square, and it has a separation in the middle, and it looks like an electromagnet. Basically, that's what it is, and you pulse it, and it very high current, and it pulls the steel right into magnetism.
You've got, what, an 8-gauge wire, a certain number of turns of it, and you charge up a half a farad capacitor with 1,000 volts. What is the actual pulse generator? And you've probably seen those YouTube-like videos where somebody makes one of these very strong magnets, and he's crushing coins, and he's crushing Coke bottle cans. Is it that kind of a thing that you're using, John? And where'd you get it? Over to you, John.
Actually, it's owned by a friend of mine, and what it is it has four of these 240 rectifiers in there, which can handle 300 amps apiece. It's fed by 500 thousandths at 240 volts DC, and that creates a magnetic field that's scary.
Are you saying 500,000 microfarads at how many volts, and then you close this god-awful switch, and you put that current through how many turns? Over to you, John.
500,000 wire, 500 circular mils, 500,000 circular mils, and it's the switch. You wouldn't believe the size of the switch. It's huge, but the thing hums like you wouldn't believe.
So in other words, you're not discharging a capacitor through the coil. You're putting steady state 400 cycle power through the coil. Is that what you're doing?
Negative. You can have that type too, which just hits the pulse. But this is a DC. It's a forget who Cullahammer makes it, and it's a DC fed item. AC goes in and has the rectifiers that feed the coil that's wound under there. The coil is actually 4-ort, and I think there's 10 turns on each wire, on each element.
Is it a capacitor that's being discharged into that coil during the magnetizing process?
No, Dick, it's brute force right off the line.
Because the guys who have done this with a huge, very low internal thermal, very low equivalent series resistance capacitor, lots of microfarads, maybe even farads, boy, do they store a lot of energy, and they put that through a coil field that's huge. The bad news is the magnetic field changes so rapidly that it tends to destroy materials. I see the problem here. You've got to bring up that magnetic field more slowly so you don't shatter your neodymium magnet. Go ahead, Wesley.
The way that Glenn described, we have a line dipole in iron, and it looks like a shorted circuit. So it looks like that shorted circuit does not have any resistance in it, because the electrons are able to spin fine. Well, the way that electricity and the electromagnetic field is made in couple